upon a star, your dreams come true.
This is Works in Progress, a podcast from the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. I'm Avishai Artsy. We're in a rehearsal room at UCLA's Royce Hall. The conceptual artist Edgar Arsenault is running actors through a scene from his new play, Boney Manili.
Yeah, you know, describe Boney Manili as a family sitcom dramedy with a magical ceiling. So the story takes place inside of a house. The two main characters is Sonny and Mama. And Sonny is a troubled playwright who was forced to move back home. And he's been for years trying to tell the story of Milli Vanilli, and he just can't seem to get it together. And at the same time, he's trying to also nurse his mother, who's slowly dying from dementia. Girl, you know it's true.
Milli Vanilli, in case you weren't around in the late 80s and early 90s, was an R&B duo made up of Fab Morvan and Rob Pilatus. Their reputation was destroyed when it was revealed that they didn't sing on their own albums and had to return their Grammy for Best New Artist.
The rest of the cast is made up of his brothers, Rob and Fab, from Milli Vanilli, and sister-in-law, who is a ghost. She actually died a year ago and came back, and nobody understands how she returned. She just is. She's fully embodied. Everybody sees her. Everybody can talk to her, but, you know, she doesn't know why she's back.
In the play Boney Manili, Mama, Sonny, and his siblings search for a missing script written by Mama's father, Sonny Sr. The legend goes that Sonny Sr. wrote the script for Disney's 1946 movie Song of the South, but was never credited for it. They hope to find the original script and sue Disney Studios, but Mama hid it and can't remember where.
So he had it typed up and he sent it over to Berkowitz Studios. Heard nothing. Yeah, gotcha. 2 years later, your grandpa Sonny's voice was on the big screen. They couldn't believe it. They'd gone through him like that.
Like, each person in the family is on their own journey trying to find something. Because they all know at some time soon they're going to lose the most important person in their lives, which is their mom and the wife of the father.
Is this set in a specific time?
It takes place in contemporary times. It's a house inside of the L.A. area. The father is migrated here from the South. He's kind of a country boy, so a lot of the kids got that kind of country way of acting, you know. But they're all like Angelinos, you know.
You missed out a little, bro. Because you know what? He was from Mississippi. So when he told his stories, he talked with that Southern drawl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and his grandma was an ex-slave. So she told him all the adventures about Br'er Fox, Br'er Bear, and Br'er Rabbit. Man, and you know what that story about Tar Baby? Oh, yeah. I heard that first from him when I was a little kid. He probably was talking about your black ass.
Edgar Arsenault's work often investigates and interrogates historical patterns. His work comes in the form of drawings, paintings, theater, film, installations, and multimedia events. The work doesn't often follow logical order. There are surreal moments and characters, and in Boney Manili, a century of history is collapsed into one night.
The play is being staged inside of an actual barbecue. So it's a theater in the round. People will literally still be standing in line to get their food when the play begins. So folks will be chewing on rib bones and chicken and macaroni and cheese and beans during the run of the performance.
Man, this shit is good, man. Tender, juicy, and sweet with no sauce.
Don't need no sauce on it, baby. Hand down through traditions and from God's hands. Them skills right there.
Yeah, dude, look good. Let me get a piece, Pop.
Hey, get off Pop's piece and get your own.
It's fine. It's
over there. Get you some.
The way in which it's constructed is that you're jumping in and out of time because, you know, the guy who created Milli Vanilli created another band 2 decades before called Boney M. She's crazy like a fool. Boney M is one of the most important pop groups in the world that most Americans have never heard about. I mean, they have record sales on the level of ABBA and Prince and, you know, the Beatles.
German record producer Frank Farian created Boney M. and later Milli Vanilli. Farian was the primary songwriter of Boney M. The disco group was made up of five black performers who mainly lip-synced to Farian's vocals.
I'm always interested in the story, kind of behind the story, you know, and when it comes to artists and musicians, you know, we're all, you know, trying to put something out there, and one of our greatest fears is to be misunderstood, you know. So I tend to be drawn to stories and try to tell stories where people have a goal, they have an aspiration, and they can't quite get there. So there's a kind of baptism of the flesh that they go through, you know. They go through a very hard time, a kind of public chastising, but it's through those flames that they get reborn again. And this is one of those stories, except you think the story is about Milli Vanilli, but it's actually really about the guy trying to tell the story about Milli Vanilli.
Right, because Milli Vanilli was never reborn, right? They had their lip-syncing scandal, and then they kind of disappeared.
You know, one of the band members passed away, unfortunately, from substance abuse. And the other one eventually struck a deal with the person who exploited him and is still singing that music today. So not the kind of redemption that we're used to in the West in our kind of Hollywood stories. And those aren't the kinds of stories that I'm interested in telling. I'm looking for something deeper than that kind of wisdom that comes out of circumstances where things just don't quite work out the way in which you hoped that they would, you know.
Arsenault mines similar territory in his first piece for the stage. It's called Until, 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 and it's based on a blackface performance at Ronald Reagan's 1981 inaugural ball, which was televised across the country. Johnny Carson introduced the performer.
And a black man, in order to appear at a white man's show, had to put on a black face so no one would know. And one of the giant stars of that era in the Ziegfeld was Burt Williams. And he kind of made fun of men's follies and foibles through his humor. And here tonight, to play tribute to Burt Williams, is Ben Vereen.
Burt Williams had been a great star of the 20s who broke the color barrier on Broadway, but he had to put on black face makeup in minstrel show style to do it. Ben Vereen began the number as a caricature, shuffling on stage in a top hat and tails, his face painted black with white lips and a big grin as he sings Waiting for the Robert E. Lee. Reagan and his supporters are laughing. The second half of the performance was more critical. Vereen, still in character, tries to buy a round of drinks at a bar for Reagan's friends, but is denied entry because of his race. Vereen ends the show singing the Burt Williams signature song, Nobody, while wiping off his blackface makeup.
I never done a thing to nobody.
I mean, if that doesn't sound crazy to you, it gets even tougher because 2 days later, Ben Vereen learned that only half of the performance was aired on TV. And the second half actually contained a critique, where the first part was a pretty true-to-form minstrel show, you know, no irony. And, you know, Ben Vereen's career and his reputation was totally smeared. And he never really had the chance to tell his side of the story. And that full performance had never really been seen. So I thought, well, let me restage it and try to tell the story from a perspective, not from a historical perspective, like with a capital H, but more from a personal perspective, which was how Ben Vereen remembered it, which was as a series of traumas that still triggers him to this day. You know, because he got death threats, you know, people spit in his face, you know, he had very prominent figures like Jesse Jackson and Ruby Dee and, you know, came out against him publicly, and he never really had his chance to say what he was trying to do.
But do you see a connection between that and Milli Vanilli in terms of a performance gone wrong and then a reputation destroyed, a career ended?
Yeah, I mean, they're entertainers, right? So they're there to put on a show. And oftentimes the artist is, because they're the face, they're left holding the bag. And there's always people behind that story whom were able to slip, the noose didn't slip around their necks, you know. And I'm like, well, what conditions created the ability for them to not get caught, and then for the artist too, you know? So you can see I'm very sympathetic to artists getting toasted and getting roasted when they're just trying to, like, you know, make the world a better place, you know what I mean? It's like, I mean, shit, you know, we just try to, you know, the stuff we do is for others, you know what I mean? I mean, of course we do it for ourselves, but, you know, I do one thing and it hopefully it benefits 100 people, you know? So, you know, we get stuck often. I want to tell those stories.
Right. And we want artists to take chances and to try risky things, to experiment, but then when they fall on their face, then, you know, maybe we're less empathetic.
Yeah, and like, what's wrong with falling on your face? I mean, some of the artists that we love the most, the ones who live and who are legends, fell on their face all the time, you know? There's just certain kinds of falls that we as a society deem to be worthy of redemption. And there's other kinds of falls that we as a society decide are not. And until I was really made a show of that starred Ben Vereen, but at the end of it, you know, the audience realizes that the show is really about them. I actually put the entire audience on the stage. And there's a similar thing that we're trying to achieve at this one, but less about like making the audience feel inculcated, but more like trying to make the audience feel like they're part of this family who's going through this loss, and that the mother, you know, wants to communicate one core thing, which is, you know, take me with you. My body may be going, but I'm still here with you. So take me with you, you know.
Take me with you, take me with you, take me with you, take me with you.
You like take my memory with you?
My memory, my spirit, my energy, my inspiration, my love, you know. Because each one of us, you are an amalgamation of, you know, not just your parents, but all the people around you, good and bad. And genetically, you know, you can trace back, you know, thousands of years. And when you think about the kinds of wisdom that a parent gives you, like, honey, you know, make sure you put on a jacket, it's cold outside, or stop eating all that sugar, it's bad for your teeth, you know. Their parents most likely told them the same thing. And then their parents most likely told their parents, right? So, like, how many generations does that go back of people essentially sharing the same kind of wisdom, you know? It's bigger than one person. And I'm hoping that in the show, and the kind of the zaniness, the funniness of it, that they feel like they were part of this family and that they want to take that love with them and to give it to someone else, you know.
Does this performance come out of any personal experience for you, or are you thinking a lot about what we inherit from our ancestors?
Yeah, I mean, it's inheritance is a funny thing because you don't ask for it. It's like the family you're born in, you know, you had no choice, right? So, you know, you got to deal with the shit, you know. But yeah, you know, the story is inspired by my mother coming down with dementia, or at least being diagnosed with dementia 3 years ago. And I started writing it before she passed away, last January. Still hard to believe it, a year has gone by. Yeah, and she was a wonderful human being. She was like the best person that I really knew. And she was a complicated person, but like so loving, like would light up a room. And, you know, to see her going through the changes that she did was really difficult. But the one thing that she never stopped being was herself. You know, she still was sweet and loving and kind, even as she stopped losing her ability to speak words, you know. And I found that to be incredibly affirming about life, that even when you start all of our experiences, our education, our religion, our, you know, being civilized, when all that stuff fades away, there's still a core part of yourself can still be expressed. And I'm fortunate that my mother was just love, and just so much love. So I was like, I want to tell a story that reflects all that complexity of loss and fear. And, you know, at the end, you know, we do the thing that people do. We keep going. We move on. Even when before that moment of the loss, you couldn't imagine that it was even possible, you know.
And with dementia, it's a gradual loss, right? It's not a sudden loss. So it's a different type of grieving, I guess.
Yeah, because you have years with the person to watch the slow change, and you know, and they know that they're going through it too. So it could be very frustrating. It could be, you know, they can begin to hate themselves, you know. But anyway, we love to laugh in our family, so we always got a good kick out of, you know, my mother's potty memory. It's been bad for a long time before the dementia, and shit, mine is pretty terrible too, so, you know. So, I mean, the humor in the show is a very funny show. And there's singing and there's dancing and, you know, it's like, you know, the humor allows us to, gives us access to the grief in a way that's not like a cliche, you know what I'm saying? Things get absurd when you start to go, you get dementia, you know. And I just wanted to bring that, the spirit of that absurdity in here, because there is something also really beautiful about being able to let go of all the rules, everything that told you what you can and can't be, what a woman is supposed to be, you know, supposed to be married when she's 20 years old and had to sacrifice her career, you know, all of those isms and boundaries and religions and dogmas, all this stuff goes away and you just... kind of a pure self. But it, that pureness also, the cost is that you're ill, you know. I'm fascinated that those two things go hand in hand, you know.
Arsenault is one of several artists in residence at UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, or CAP-UCLA. Fred Frumberg is CAP-UCLA's deputy director and program manager and co-interim director.
So basically, a lot of what CAP does is create circumstances in which we can really support young artists in creating new work, or even established artists in, who need space and need resources. And, you know, we have our own modest resources, so we do what we can. So that might mean just providing a space, for example. It might mean providing some modest production costs. It depends on whether or not this is a piece that we're going to eventually present as a final work, or if we really want to just focus on the creative development. We do both, you know. So in the case of Edgar, for example, in his case, we've known him now for a number of years. We've been talking about this piece for a while, and he's been doing his own development and fundraising to do some creative work on the side and a lot of the rewriting of the play. And we've been able to offer him our rehearsal room a couple of times now for two different residencies. And eventually we will actually present his work as part of the opening season of the new Nimoy Theater. So that'll be in the spring of 23.
The UCLA Nimoy Theater will be housed in what had been the Crest Theater in downtown Westwood. It'll be a contemporary performing arts space that'll seat close to 300 people and that CAP-UCLA will operate and manage. It'll provide a smaller venue than Royce Hall or the theater at the Ace Hotel, CAP-UCLA's two main venues. It's named in honor of actor Leonard Nimoy.
And I'm a big Star Trek fan. Now, I'm not a Trekkie, but I spend a lot of time with the material. And my dad is also big into Star Trek, and I've done a lot of drawings of Leonard Nimoy, so it would be kind of dope to be able to premiere the piece. He actually owns a piece of mine, too. It was I did a drawing of him, and he owned one of them, and it was in his study.
While working on Boney Manili, Arsenault also has a show of his work on view at the Vielmetter Los Angeles Gallery in downtown L.A. The show is called Skinning the Mirror and is made up of mirrors with the silver nitrate scraped off the back, mounted on canvases, and covered in acrylic paint.
I tend to develop very different projects dealing with the same themes at the same time, and so that's a series of paintings in which I had kind of pioneered this technique where you can skin a mirror and separate the silver from the glass. So, and then turning it into a painting technique. So oftentimes the glass is broken along the way, and the paint that I use to remove the silver will start to push itself out through the cracks and the crevices. And so you get these really bold expressions of color. And, you know, I was generating that work as a series of abstract paintings, and then as my mom got sicker, and her mind started going, I realized that the breaking of the mirror was analogous to what I saw, sort of the breaking in my mother's mind. But that also, like, I learned something really beautiful too, which is that when glass breaks, and you've probably seen this on a windshield, like if your windshield's ever been chipped, and you think that that little crack is going to stay right there, and then by the end of the day, it stretched itself out all the way to the ends of the glass. You know what? When glass breaks, it seeks closure. It seeks the closing of the loop. I kind of think of it as like it seeks an embrace, you know, to relieve its tension. And some of those metaphors, I think, express themselves both in those paintings and then also in this piece too, you know.
Both the play and the paintings are inspired by the loss of his mother, Merck Marie Arsenault Sr., to dementia. Arsenault likes to tell stories that explore the blurry lines between past and present, fact and fiction.
I have a general love of understanding how things work. I'm kind of like the Mr. Rogers of the art world, you know. I'm like, I want to go to the eraser factory and see how they're made, you know. I'm always curious about why things look a certain way, what forces shaped them that might no longer be visible, you know, like what made the Grand Canyon, for example. And then you have to imagine the water because it's already gone. And you can see all the different layers of the seabed that are left behind from millennia ago or eons ago, you know. I find those expressions of the past kind of poking themselves out in the present to be, like, so fascinating. But when it comes to social history, like in politics, oftentimes the things are obscured, that were intentionally erased or defaced or just forgotten. So I like to show people a story that they think they know and then come at an angle that shows them it in an entirely new way or kind of a fresh way. Like when I choose a moment, like this story, for example, with Boney M. and Milli Vanilli, I'm looking for moments in time that give you a sense of both the transient present as well as like the archetypal past. So something that can show you a moment right now that then also aligns with a window that tells you something about the past. And like, I had this question that I always ask myself about history, which is, if a historical subject is asserting itself in the present, what is it doing here now? Why does it want to be known at this moment, as opposed to the millions or billions of other things that could be, you know, being engaged?
And that's part of a bigger conversation that we're having now about monuments, memorials, what we choose to remember and how we choose to remember it.
Right. Yeah, and there's an interesting paradox to memorials, and in death we see it all the time, you know. But you know, when we memorialize something, you know, we write it down because it gives us permission to forget about it. It gives us permission to move on, you know. Like, you can't remember something until you've forgotten it, right? But then there's also the political dimension of the memorial, which is to present an idea of something which perhaps never existed, and then they want it to be true. They want to recall. They want to imagine something as a memory, even though it never really happened.
Right. And sometimes the memorial tells you more about the time in which it was erected than the time it's trying to capture or relive somehow.
Exactly. So you know, with the I try to be very thoughtful about the subjects that I choose to make artwork about, because it needs that level of unsettledness. It needs to feel like an object that doesn't quite sit square on the table. Like it needs to be, you know, have a kind of potential to fall over and upset the order. Those are the stories that I want to tell.
And so it sounds like research is a big part of your process too, either research into materials or research into history. And is that true with Boney Manili too? Were you spending a lot of time watching videos and reading about them?
I probably have a volume, probably a book or two I could write about this subject now. Just the levels of like the branches of exploration, you know. And you know, when you do research, it's really a journey, because you don't know what you're going to find. And oftentimes you find yourself exactly back where you started, which is sometimes it's amazing. Sometimes it's like really fucked up. He's like, man, I could have just saved some time and just did the very first thing I thought of. And, you know, and I'm 2 years, I came back again. But I'm being funny, but you know, you never come back the same. You may be standing in the same point, but you know, the journey just makes everything so much fuller and, you know, so much richer.
Well, at least then you know that the idea you had at the beginning was the right one all along.
Well, yes. Yeah, hindsight. It's 2020, as they say.
Okay, well, Edgar Arsenault, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for coming by and being interested in our project.
That's Edgar Arsenault. Boney Manili is set to be performed at the Nimoy Theater in the spring of 2023. His show Skinning the Mirror is at Veal Matter Los Angeles through March 12, 2022. You've been listening to Works in Progress, a podcast from the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. I'm Avishai Artsy. Thanks for listening, and be well.